Well, thanks, Steve, for coming. So that's great. And hopefully, I shall reveal what the title is about. I really appreciate it very much, your introduction. Thank you. So, I'll just tell you a bit about the background to my interest in this particular topic. And about 6 or 7 years ago, I was co-leading a retreat, Buddhafield Retreat, just an outdoor retreat. And the topic was about the three lakshanas, which is the three characteristics of existence, which we'll come back to later in the talk. And we were doing these poetry sessions in the afternoon, and it was my role at some point to pick out the poems that were to do with suffering, dukkha. That's one of the three characteristics of existence. So I had this book with me, Zen Poetry, the Penguin Book of Zen Poetry. So I started to hunt for books that contained some sort of reference to suffering, and to my surprise, most of those poems that had suffering in it also had insects in them. So I was just so surprised by that, and I got really interested in that. I got, in fact, so interested that I started on my computer. I've got this huge file, which is like a whole book about this topic. So lots of references to insects and to particular poems. And at some point, I started to branch out into references of insects in the Pali Canon, you know, the original teachings, Buddhist teachings. And so in the past few days, I always hoped I was going to do something with this topic, and I'm really pleased I have now the opportunity to do something with it. So in the past days, I've tried to condense what I have on that computer and tried to draw out some of the main threads, as it were. But I also very much realise that there's just so much in this topic you wouldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. And I haven't even skimmed the surface yet with this. So it's a work in progress, and so I hope that you bear with me. So it's a process, okay? So it's a process. So bear with me. And I'm going to talk about... So that was my disclaimer. Yeah. Also, just as a remark, I was living in the mountains at the time, in the mountains in Spain, when I was making these notes. And I've just been reading through my notes. I just really noticed the difference between living in London and living in nature. So there's a kind of a lack of depth in my reflection at the moment, which has to do with just living in a very different environment, because somehow... that environment, being in nature, having more space for reflection, for meditation, and also more solitude, it kind of gets you into a space where these insect encounters really start to be really significant. Mm-hmm. And so those of you who have been reading any kind of Zen poetry, there is that kind of presence in Zen poetry as well. There is this kind of it's a bit like you've got this magnifying glass and you're looking at reality and it starts to speak on its own level, as it were. So you're getting into a space with solitude, reflection, meditation, maybe more a retreat-like space where those you get more sort of tuned into the subtleties of the environment. So also you're getting more tuned into what is scuffling, what is sort of, you know, what is happening around you and all these small creatures around you as well. You just notice them more and they become more significant somehow. And also, if you think about the life of the Buddha, the Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago, most of his life is led outdoors. And so he'd be in rainforests, I don't know whether he was in rainforest. He was in forests, he had jungles, tropical environments. And maybe he was sleeping in huts, he was walking down roads, maybe on his bare feet or some sandals. But the thing is that he would be in an environment where he would be encountering much more insects, many, 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 many insects, much more than we do today, because we've got this clinical environment, actually. We've got this kind of these boxes, and whenever we see an insect, they don't kind of belong in there. You want to kind of, you know, they need to go away. So it's just very, very different. So when you go on a retreat, like a Buddha field retreat, for instance, one of the realities is that you get to meet lots and lots more insects. It's true. Whenever, you know, wherever you look, they'll be there. And you don't want them to be there, but they're still there.
Yeah.
So whenever, for instance, you put a glass of water out there and you walk away, 5 minutes later, there'll be some insects drifting in. And anyway, you know, you'll just meet loads and loads of insects. And in that sense, it's quite an interesting symbol, because they are a bit like... that kind of, when I think about a Buddha field retreat in the past, I noticed when I go on a real retreat how I've kind of edited out the insects. And they really offer a level of discomfort, unsatisfactoriness, which is quite interesting. You could somehow relate to just the very presence of those insects in these environments as that kind of a basic sense of unsatisfactoriness that's just inherent to existence. Anyway, I've got loads of these thoughts, so you've got to bear with me. So this is there is a lot in there, I find. So I wanted to say a bit about these Japanese poems, because I did some research on that, and one of the most well-known haiku poets is called Issa. Maybe some people might have heard of him. So it's a poet called Issa, and especially Issa in his poems, there's a lot of preoccupation with small beings, like it could be mice or insects. And another characteristic of his writing is that there's a lot of compassion for those very small beings too. So he really is the poet with the compassion for the small beings. So there'll be a lot of Issa poems in his talk. But so he, most of his life was wandering around the Japanese countryside, traveling from town to town. And he would be writing thousands of these poems. And so somebody actually counted these. So he composed more than 500 haiku about arthropods. Is that how you pronounce it? Arthropods? They're not exactly insects. It's another class of beings that is also spiders are included, and I think crabs and lobsters are also included in that. So it's like a whole class of beings. So 500 poems only about them. And he wrote about 150 haikus about flies, featuring flies, and dozens of poems about fleas and mosquitoes. Anyway, so some of these are just loose thoughts, and then I'm going to get into the Buddhist teachings. This is just a few thoughts I wanted to start off with. So also we find a lot of insects in the Buddhist tradition, in the Zen poets. But we also find a lot of insects in the Pali canon. But my interest is mainly drawn to the Zen poets. But also there are lots of insects in the Pali canon. But I haven't done as much research on that as I've done on the Zen poetry. But if you look at the teachings as written down in the Pali canon, one of the most famous... The famous stories to do with insects is the parable of the ant hill. So that's one of a famous story in the Majjhima Nikaya, one of the collections of the Pali Canon. And in this particular sutta, there is a monk called Kassapa who has a dream. And in his dream, he's digging in his ant hill, and he's digging in his ant hill, and he's just finding lots of different objects. And I'm not going to go into all the stuff that he finds, but he finds object, and then he digs again. He finds another object, and digs again. He finds another object, until at the end of his digging, he comes to, I think, a symbol of a serpent, a naga. And in the Buddhist tradition, that resembles, that's wisdom. The naga stands for wisdom. So if you follow all these objects that he finds in this anthill, they're all representing sort of layers of practice. So you're kind of digging into, it's a bit like when you're doing Buddhist practice, sometimes it's compared to like peeling an onion. Mm-hmm. You're peeling layer after layer after layer after layer until there's nothing left. But so it's that kind of, it's like in the Buddhist practice, maybe hopefully in the course of time there's this transformation that takes place, which kind of that is represented by these objects that are found in this anthill. So that's like the major, that's the big, the biggest insect parable that I found. But there's a few more, and hopefully we'll hear a few more tonight. And I also came across a saying by the Dalai Lama, which I really liked, which was going around on Facebook last year sometime. I really liked it. And this is about, I'll just read it. If you think you're too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito, which I really find very charming. Yeah. So if you think you're too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito. It kind of, you know, indicates you've got this, you know, we've got these big, strong bodies, and you've got this tiny insect, but this tiny insect can kind of make life quite difficult for you, yeah? Bug you. So another fact about insects, which I found interesting, just picture this. For every human being, there are about, listen to this, 1.5 billion insects. Yeah, so that's the scale. For one human being, 1.5 billion insects. So it's quite a lot of them. It was kind of explains why you see so many of them. But the thing about this, it did really make me think about, in the Buddhist tradition, you have a teaching which has to do with the preciousness of human existence. And in the tradition, it's like you've got this sort of sea, and there is this... there's something floating in the... What's this thing floating in the sea?
A yolk.
Yeah, there's a yolk floating in the sea, and there's this turtle coming up once every 100 years, and he comes up and he kind of sticks his neck through that yolk. So that the statistical chance of that is kind of quite minimal. But the statistical chance to be born as a human being is just mind-boggling, if you see what I mean. So a being is born... The chance that's a human being, if you compare it to all the insects, it's just amazing. And in the tradition, we're pointed at this preciousness of human life to show us, okay, here we've got this life, we've got this body, let's do some practice. Yeah. So it's a massive opportunity to have a body, and let's not throw it away. So that's the whole idea. Let's use it and just utilize it and do some practice that leads away from suffering. Yes, that's the core of the Buddhist teachings. So that's why the Buddha started to go on his whole journey to find somehow an alleviation or some sort of antidote to human suffering. Yeah. Okay. So this preciousness of human existence. And I've often found in these insect encounters, there you are, and there's this tiny, small being, and it just really makes me reflect on what's happening. Or it's a bit like gazing at the stars, really, seeing all these stars and kind of sort of feeling like, what's going on? What's the meaning of all of this? You know, what are we, you know, in relation to each other, this small insect and myself? What does it mean to be a human being? If you see what I mean, that's the kind of reflections that I start to have when I'm meeting an insect, if I'm in a more reflective kind of mode, you see what I mean? Yeah. So what is going on? So here I've got a haiku, or one of those Zen poems by Issa. A man, just one, also a fly, just one, in the huge drawing room. So a man, just one, also a fly, just one, in the huge drawing room. Issa. So just, there is, I think, also an Emily Dickinson poem, isn't there? There is an Emily Dickinson poem which starts, I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room is like the stillness in the air, between the heaves of storm. So it's a scene of somebody dying, and there is this kind of buzzing of that insect, and it's just so significant somehow. So you can sometimes walk into a room at home, or you're just in a room, and all of a sudden there's this insect that appears. And, well, anyway, it does bring about that kind of, what is going on? What does my life mean? What is the meaning of all of this? What is the significance of all this? Yeah. So I'm just moving on to some of the Buddhist texts, there is a definition of body, which is very much tied in with insects. So that's why, obviously, I'm mentioning it here. So I'll just read that out. So rupa is another word for body. Yeah. I'm just moving on to a topic which is more about the human body in relation to this topic. So here's a definition of rupa. And why rupa is so called? It is affected, therefore it's called rupam. By what is it affected? It's affected by cold, by heat, by thirst and hunger, by contact with flies, insects and mosquito. It's affected, therefore, monks, it's called rupa. I just found it really interesting, you know, just being searching for insects in the Pali Canon, just find it really significant that this definition about what is body is somehow defined by what are the sensations experienced in the body. And some of them, it becomes very evident if you spend a lot of time in nature, it's that kind of, because you feel something crawling, crawling over in your skin, or you feel the kind of itching of something. It's like, okay, yeah, they're here, this is it, this is the body, yeah. And in the Bodhicaryavatara, which is also another Buddhist text, we were studying it in our study group last week, and I came across this other quote, which is about the practice of patience. Because insects, now we're starting to get into how can you practice with insects. Well, insects can help you practicing patience or forbearance, or it's called kshanti in the tradition. Yeah. So I'll read out this next bit. With practice, anything becomes easy. So by learning to tolerate slight discomforts, even great pain becomes bearable. So we should practice seeing the discomfort caused by bugs, fleas and mosquitoes, hunger and thirst, or itches and rashes as nothing to bother about. Then we will be able to graduate to the suffering caused by cold and heat, rain and wind, travelling, illness, and eventually even imprisonment and beatings. If we don't learn to tolerate these things, our mental distress will just make us suffer even more. So this is from the Bodhicaryavatara, a text by Shantideva, which is a text which is all about a journey towards becoming, especially developing more compassion. So I found that really interesting to read that you can actually use that, the contact with those insects, to practice patience. So rather than when an insect happens, rather than kind of trying, you know, reacting to it or trying to, so, you know, try to wipe it away or chase it away, you could sort of practice just being with that insect for a while and see what it is like, and then hopefully that will result in more forbearance for the more important things that we need forbearance with. It's quite an important quality, this quality of patience. And I was very much reminded, Carmen Sheila once told me this story about, I just couldn't believe this, but he did tell me this story, that one day he was meditating outdoors or on a retreat, I can't remember, and then a bee came. I promised you a bee, didn't I, Mark? Yeah, here's the bee. So a bee came and he flew in his ear, his baby flew in his ear. And then, you know, I was just asking, what did you do with this bee in his ear? He said, well, you know, I just continued meditating. And then after a minute or so, the bee just, you know, he just went out and flew away. But I just thought it was just quite a lovely example of...
Is that out of the other ear?
No, no. No, the same ear. But I was just quite fascinated. I was just wondering, what has this bee been doing in that ear, gathering some... I don't know what he was doing, but I just thought it was a really beautiful example of this quality of forbearance. So he must have had quite a lot of forbearance in order just to sit there and just wait for the bee to leave him. Yeah? So, yes, and a lot of that, if you go on a Buddha field retreat, I'm kind of plugging Buddha field retreats here, I guess, but there's one that's happening in June, and Carmen Sheila is leading that. It's just wonderful, really, because there are a lot of those challenges with insects and all kinds. It's a simple life, but it does give you a taste of what the Buddha's life must have been like, you know. It's probably much less luxurious, yeah. But still, it's a great opportunity. So I've got another haiku here. So I felt this was quite a lovely expression of this quality of forbearance. Zazen, fat mosquitoes everywhere. Yeah. Zazen, fat mosquitoes everywhere. For those who don't know, Zazen is just another word for meditation. It's the meditation that is practiced in the Zen tradition, Zazen. So you can imagine all these monks sitting there being bitten by the mosquitoes. Anyway, so Zazen, fat mosquitoes everywhere. That's a haiku by somebody called Taigi. And for the book that I was writing, I mean, I'm not sure whether I'm ever going to write it, but I had all these exercises in there as well, so I just thought if ever you find yourself in an environment where there's insects, you could try that. You could just try sitting there and being patient with the insects. And in my notes I found I did this exercise and I had this... like all these insects came and there were like three different flies crawling on my hand and there was a caterpillar crawling on my leg and there were bees buzzing around. It was quite amazing, I thought. But so I found it quite interesting that so the moment that one of the insects lands or you notice it, there is a sense of... You kind of feel like you're attacked or you don't feel at ease somehow. Mm. And I was thinking somehow that's a really good demonstration of, it's another Buddhist concept, this ego clinging. So you're feeling you're under threat. So I found that like practicing with insects, it's a really good way to show you this kind of tendency of that is called ego clinging, which I won't go into because I don't have time, okay? Okay. I've just got to check how I'm doing with time. Okay. So moving on to a topic which I've labelled here non-harm. So it's also connected to insects, as you might predict by now. So as you may know, the first precept first of the five ethical precepts that Buddhists undertake to practice is the practice of non-harm. So you actually say, I undertake to abstain from taking life. And I think usually it's more interpreted in terms of the taking life as a human being, and then we think, okay, well, I don't kill anyone, so I don't have to kind of practice this precept. But obviously this precept needs to be applied to all living beings. So you get animals, Yeah, you get the bigger animals like the cows and the tigers and the dogs, but you get the smaller ones too. Yeah, you get the insects too. So I find that quite interesting. This whole topic is quite interesting because I think most of us, even if you're practicing this precept of non-violence and non-harm, this is, I think, one of the most challenging practices in terms of insects and how not to kill them. So I've got another haiku here by someone called Shusun Kato, a 20th century Japanese haiku poet. I kill an ant and realize my three children have been watching. So I kill an ant and realize my three children have been watching. I just find it quite interesting that, you know, there is something, some sort of remorse probably, that you feel when you're killing an insect. Most people do at some point, not all the time probably, but it's kind of, it is something probably that keeps coming back to you. And I just thought this was such an excellent way of, like you've got these three children as witnesses and they kind of see you doing that, and they see you doing something that actually maybe deep down you kind of think, this is probably not a good thing to do. So in the Tibetan tradition, there's a lot of advice on human beings and insects and killing them and how to cope with that. And they're going really, really far in that. I think it's quite alien from how we usually think about insects. So the Tibetans, some Tibetans, the practicing Buddhists, I guess, really try to make sure they don't hurt any insects. So that makes building quite difficult, because Tibetans, when they start building a building, it's taking forever and ever because they've got to remove all the insects from the earth before they can... I'm looking at the architect in the crowd here. Just imagine having to work with a crew that need to remove all the insects before they can do another dig. They find that really important, and so there is all kinds of advice that you could do in relation to this killing of insects. You can do, especially after you've been killing insects, visualizations that you can do, mantras that you can do, and they're going really far, because what they, for instance, would do, they would collect the worms or whatever from when they've been digging and they find these insects. They might put them in a bag and circumambulate like holy relics or stupas, so that the bugs can get enlightened in another, you know, or at least that they could be. You were talking about how you could be reborn as an insect, but this practice would be about that these insects would then have the chance to be reborn in a body that would allow them to practice the Buddhist teachings. I mean, for me, it goes a bit too far, but I do have a lot of, you know, I feel very fond of this somehow. I'd like to get to a point that I'd be more in that kind of space with it, if you see what I mean. So there are, for instance, the mantras that people can, in the Buddhist tradition, there are mantras that people can chant before they're putting their shoes on. They've got this mantra, and they chant this mantra a few times, and they even spit on the soles of their shoes. So they won't be squashing insects when they go out walking in their shoes, you see what I mean? So they're trying to be really careful with that. It's also said, actually, that if you'd be quite far in terms of having practiced the Buddhist teachings, if you have become a stream entrant, as it is called, that beings would just go away. That stream entrant wouldn't even, you know, walk on them. I don't know, but so that's what is said in the tradition.
And what is the mantra they chant?
It's Om Kraitsaragana Hongri. So, there you are. But I do feel I need to get into confession territory here, because I'm going to tell you a story about my own encounters with insects. And the first I feel a bit embarrassed about, but I'll say it anyway. When I was a child, Sometimes I would really want to have something sweet. And I've had a magnifying glass, I had sugar, and I had a piece of wood. So what I would do, sometimes, not very often, I would put the magnet, and it would be, have to be some, I'd caramelise the sugar and actually lick it because I wanted something sweet. So that's what I would do. And one time when I was doing that, there was a fly that had come, obviously attracted by the sugar, and I had this magnifying glass. And I kind of had this moment like, what am I going to do now? And I did not somehow remove the magnifying glass, yeah? And I felt awful. I felt awful afterwards. I just felt like that mental state I'd been feeling doing that, I just really felt awful. I think that's why the memories really stayed with me. So, yes, I did feel deeply ashamed after that, and I've been trying to avoid it ever since. But there's another haiku here by somebody called Shiki. After killing a spider, how lonely I feel in the cold of night. After killing a spider, how lonely I feel in the cold of night. So I had another one, which is much later. This is going to progress, you see. I'm hoping there's a bit more compassion in the journey there. But so this is me in my early 20s, and we had lots of ants in the house. That's awful, you know, they're just everywhere. They're coming from the garden, they're coming everywhere. So I had this problem, like, what to do? And I really didn't know what to do with them. And so at some point, I was wanting to make a cup of tea, and I already ants in the tea and in the kind of cup. So what I actually did is I just put it under the tap and I flushed them through and I felt awful. And at that point, what happened, this is what happened, is I'm not kidding you, what happened, I saw this lone ant running across the sink and then kind of looking over the edge. Oh, I really, it was awful. And and I had this, at the time I was really into Wagner, I had this kind of Tristan and Isolde kind of thing. I said, oh my God, I've just flushed somebody's lover through the sink. And now we've got this lonely ant. It was awful, absolutely awful. But I think, you know, I've really started to try to stay clear of that after that, I can tell you that, yeah. So I think the most important thing here is this: is the intention. Yeah? Yeah. So the intention not to kill, and it's not that easy with moths and all these small creatures. But there is something really valuable in trying to not water the seed of cruelty. Yeah. And it does sort of seem to happen there, that there's going to be more cruelty. You're developing more cruelty by sort of numbing yourself in this particular area, if you see what I mean. So I don't want to kind of be too strong here, but that's the kind of territory, if you kind of, you know, want to go into detail here. So I've got this last haiku on this session. All the time, I pray to Buddha, I keep on killing mosquitoes. That's Issa. So all the time I pray to Buddha, I keep on killing mosquitoes. I thought that's quite... Yeah. Anyway, it does illustrate it. Don't have to say anything about that, don't I? So now I'm coming to another story from the Buddhist tradition again. And this is actually from a text by Ashvaghosha called the Buddhacharita. And I think a lot of you might have heard of the story of the Buddha under the rose apple tree. But I was a bit confused about this. I think this does seem to give a different take on it in this text. But I'll just read out a bit so it indicates why I've chosen to read out this text. So this is the Buddha arriving in a field that has been ploughed, or I think they're going to build there. I think it's been ploughed, actually. So this is the text. Having beheld the ground in this condition, with its young grass scattered and torn by the plough, and covered with the eggs and young of little insects which were killed, he was filled with deep sorrow as for the slaughter of his own kindred. So So this, him, the Buddha, noticing this, he's also noticing, and beholding the men as they were ploughing, their complexions spoiled by the dust, the sun's rays and the wind, and their cattle bewildered with the burning of drawing, the most noble one felt extreme compassion. So this seems to be quite an important passage in the tradition. So you get this... It is said, actually, that after this moment, the Buddha was really set on his journey to finding a solution somehow to the suffering of all beings, or finding some sort of salvation for all beings, from the suffering of all beings, if you see what I mean. So it apparently is from this moment onwards that his mind was set to doing that after this. I quite like that, just him finding those insects and the eggs, and that generating such a strong impulse. Yes, and then we have another really famous story, more from the Mahayana tradition, I guess. It's and I think a lot of people might know this story. It's about the maggots and the Sangha. Have you heard the story about the maggots? Yeah. Well, this is a Sangha who's going to meditate in a cave. And he is meditating for years and years. And he would like to have this vision of a particular Buddha called Maitreya. That's he really wants to get a vision or see Maitreya. So he's meditating for about years, and then he comes out, and at some point when he is on his way out, he finds this guy who's got this iron rod, and he's kind of using this piece of cloth, and he's asking, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm trying to make a needle, because I don't have a needle, so I'm trying to kind of polish this iron bar so it turns into a needle, yeah?" So he thinks like, wow, you know. They're putting a lot of effort into all of this. I haven't put as much effort as that in my meditation. So I'm going to go back into my cave and try a bit more. So then he's meditating for another few years. He comes out again and he finds this guy, and he's got this feather, and there's this mountain, and he's trying with his feather to kind of, you know, reduce this mountain, because I don't quite know why, but he's trying to. And he thinks, again, I haven't really tried hard enough, I'm going to go back into my cave. So the last time he comes out of the cave, he sees this a little village. He sees this a dog, and the dog is wounded, and I think both his legs have been ripped off. He's only got these front legs, and there's a lot of maggots on his where the wound is, I guess. Yeah. So this is the situation, and so he is going to help this dog, and then he's going to remove these maggots. But then he thinks, oh, maybe these maggots will get damaged if I just grab them with my hand, so I'll better use my tongue.
Oh!
So he sticks out his tongue. So he sticks out his tongue to kind of start licking away the maggots. And then the moment he does that, he touches the ground, right, and the dog's disappeared, and this Buddha Maitreya is come in place of the dog. The story continues for a bit, but the illustration is something around that deep compassion that has seemed to have arisen in this particular Buddhist practitioner. So, how are we doing? Yeah, still there? Good. I've got a few more stories here. I'm going to go back to another story about my own encounters with insects, because it's a bit chronological, actually. So this is a story about, I was living in a flat in Amsterdam at the time. I used to live there, and the building had quite a few flats, and there were cockroaches in this. Yeah. They're notoriously difficult to get rid of, and, you know, it's not easy living with cockroaches, yeah? So I had seen that. I had seen that they were near my. They were kind of always climbing down the tea towel. I was thinking, why are they there? And there was this electric toothbrush there, and it was, you know, the charger for electric toothbrush. So at some point I thought, why? And all of a sudden I thought, oh no. So I picked up the charger of this toothbrush and I looked inside. There is this kind of, you know, cave-like thing. And there was this giant cockroach there doing this. And all these eggs around it in my toothbrush, in the charger of my toothbrush. Anyway, it was a horrifying moment, I can tell you that. But the thing is...
Who are you?
I know. It was a horrifying moment. Especially, I can still see it. All these eggs, you know, they've got thousands of eggs around. It's beautiful, isn't it? Like really, really warm and nice. So the thing is, what I did was I went into what you could describe as horrified anxiety, which is a near enemy of compassion, by the way. It just means that you're so caught up in your own feelings that you can't really do much for the being that you're, you know, that sparks it off. So I actually just put the whole thing in a bag and I run out into the street and I dumped it. Anyway, I'm improving. I'm really improving for the years. I'm really improving for the years. But
that's
anyway,
that's the one insect that apparently can survive a nuclear attack.
Yes. Yes, they're incredible. They're really incredible. I looked it up, actually, that I looked something up because I was quite interested about the ages of insects because... One of the things that's so interesting about insects are usually quite small and human beings are quite big, but also the age, there's a lot of difference there in terms of how some flies don't get very old, do they? But apparently there's some beings that get to be 50 years old, like insects, some beetles and some cockroaches, not all of them, but particular species, can become incredibly old. I was quite surprised by that. I didn't know. I thought they all kind of lived a fairly short time. Anyway, so that's, I just wanted to say that is, because we are still under this heading of compassion, that, yes, responding with horrified anxiety, obviously is not compassion, but it's like, it's the near enemy, yeah? So there is progress here. I'm not going to tell you all these horrible encounters with insects, because I haven't, you know, I can't come back here.
We all have, dear, so don't worry.
I'm just going to continue, then I'll tell you another one then, yeah? Because they're quite big, yeah? Big encounters, yeah? So this is also I found quite interesting, because I was actually walking on a dusty road in Kushinara. And Kushinara, that's in India. And that's where, allegedly, that's where the Buddha must have died. So that's there about. You've got this big Parinirvana there, and there were lots of monks circumambulating the Parinirvana Buddha. And I was walking down this dusty road, and all of a sudden I felt something in my sandal, and I saw this huge grasshopper in my sword. I shouldn't raise my voice. So it was just, yeah. It was huge, and it was like caught in my sandal, yeah. You see what I mean? And I went like, you know, trying to shake it. But the poor being, you know, it was just, you know, it didn't survive it. That's the difficulty when you're an insect. It's like there's so many potential ways to die every day. It's just incredible. They're dying all the time. So, you know, in my sandal. And this is quite interesting again, because my friend, because he's kind of, you know, he was in one of those states that there was some green fluid leaking out. And it obviously was not great. And you can't sort of call for the ambulance or anything. So what my friend was looking at me like, you know, complete disdain, you know. She just, total lack of compassion. Never mind. And she just stumped her foot on it because she thought... It was quite interesting. I found it really interesting because we'd been discussing it for hours later, this particular incident, because she felt it's just hurt so much, I've got to end its life. And so that's why she stomped on it. She just thought, then it doesn't suffer anymore. And it really sparked off a thought process in me for many years after. It's like, what is this about in terms of... For instance, you find a dead and not a dying creature on the road, and is it more kind to kill it? Or do you feel it needs to have its own dying process? you know, I think all of us probably sometimes are in these particular situations. You find a small creature, it's, you don't quite know what to do, but yeah, what's the options really? So I found that really interesting to think about it and talk to her about it. But then, as I was making these notes for this talk, this is another. I'm now on a retreat in Spain, and this is a month retreat, a silent retreat, a month of silence in, I think it was June in a valley near Valencia, and I started to collect images for metta, for loving kindness, because I felt that helped my meditation. And one of the best images of that whole retreat was, it was again, I just only discovered that today, I found it quite interesting, that I was not in a very good state somehow, and a bit sort of, I don't know, sad, or I can't remember, upset, whatever. So I went into the lowest part of the valley, and there were a huge amount of butterflies there. And one small blue butterfly landed on my sandal. And it completely opened up my mood, and it just shifted it into something quite open and friendly. And it's just quite amazing. So this really small butterfly landing on my sandal, but I could just see the correlation, if you see what I mean, with the sandal incident earlier on, and then this other sandal incident later in time, a few years later. Yeah, that was quite amazing. So when you do go on retreat and you're outdoors a lot, and you do start to notice, you know, the behaviour of insects much more. So I think all of us on that retreat were just totally interested in insects. So sometimes we'd been eating outdoors and you'd saw these ants sort of carrying this small grain of quinoa, for instance, you know, and you think, what on earth, you know, it's just massive, sort of must be massive for them. It's just quite curious to look at it. So I'll just finish that sequence, because there is a bit of a sequence here, I guess. So this is me on another Buddha field retreat, which is also a lot of silence, a month. This is a field in Devon. And I was just throwing out, as one does, a bowl of water that I'd used for, I don't know, washing my hands or whatever. I was throwing it out. And as I was kind of throwing it out, I noticed there was this insect that was kind of sort of drowned at the bottom of it. So I just thought, oh, let's see if I could do a bit of a rescue thing. So I kind of sort of tried to put it on my finger. So it was on my finger. So this insect was on my finger. And it was wet, but it was still alive. And I was thinking, well, maybe there's a chance here. Maybe he'll live. I'll do my best. I'll try something. So I start blowing on it, like. And slowly, it started to move, and it started to kind of, you know, wriggle, and sort of, you know, he just started to make use of that, of me blowing on it, and, you know, and at some point, it just seemed to be completely dry. And there I was with that insect on my finger. I'd been with that insect for like 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And I just got a bit bored by that. I've had enough now, you know. I've been blowing on this insect. It's okay now. Goodbye. So then at least, you know, it flew away. But it was, I see a bit of a progression there, if you see what I mean. So this is also another one in the Yashobodhi and insect stories. And this is about processionary caterpillars. Have you ever heard of processionary caterpillars? Yes, there's one yes there, but not... They're following each other, so they form a chain, and it can be 100 caterpillars in one chain. And I'd never heard of them before, but I went on this three-month retreat in the Spanish mountains, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, and I'd never heard of them, but I was meditating quite a bit, and there I was, I just discovered these processionary caterpillars, and I was just fascinated by them, because what also happens is somehow they kind of lose the way, and they all ended up they're all ending up in one knot.
Yeah.
You get 100
ball,
yeah, you can get 100 caterpillars and they're kind of all wriggling, yeah. wriggling around. So I just thought, I encountered that. I just saw this knot of all these caterpillars, and I just sat there. And first I thought, I just got to, you know, somebody's going to come along and eat them. I didn't know they had no natural enemies at the time, so I was kind of a bit concerned for them. They'd be eaten by the birds or whatever. So I was just sitting there. And I was getting really irritated with them as well. I thought, stupid animals, you know, what is this about? You know, all going around in a knot, just, you know. I was getting a bit impatient with them. And then I was noticing my mental state. I thought, actually, I think a compassionate response is probably more appropriate at this particular time rather than getting annoyed by them. So, and this has actually really happened. It's really happened. So I thought, I'll chant the Amitabha mantra for them. So I started to chant the Amitabha mantra for them. But really, what happened is I just saw this kind of one head sticking out, and then he started crawling away, and then they were on their way a few minutes later. It's just quite amazing. It could be complete coincidence, but this is actually really what happened.
Power up on me, gentlemen.
Anyway, I've got to rush now. I just throw this in for fun. This one, I quite like this one. There's also about yourself. Mosquito larva dancing a Buddhist chant in the water by the grave. Buddhist larva dancing a Buddhist chant in the water by the grave. I'm never going to make it through all this, all these notes. I've got to make a decision now. So I had this quite a lot of fun earlier. In Buddhism, you have suffering. You can there's seven forms of suffering, as it were. So I found haikus for all the forms of suffering, which I had a lot of fun with. But I'm not sure that I've got time for that now. Well, you know, I'll never make it to the end anyway. So I think what I'll do is just... So some of these three lakshanas, three characteristics of existence, the first one is impermanence. And then there is one that's called insubstantiality. You could also say interconnectedness. And then there is one that is about suffering. So you've got these three types. And a load of these Japanese poems have those images in them. It's just extraordinary, I found. So I think what I'll do, just because I think I've talked quite enough. So I don't have time to go into the interconnectedness or the impermanence. I think I'll just finish off with these haikus about suffering. So that would be a way to finish. I'll probably have time for all of them if I don't dwell on them too much. So the first type of suffering has to do with birth. Just the very fact that we are born brings about suffering for the baby, the mother, the father, whatever. So there is some suffering inherent in being born. So we've got haiku for that. Baby in a basket, licking the edge of her mouth, little butterfly. So baby in a basket, licking the edge of her mouth, little butterfly. Which is quite a sweet image, but at the same time, just imagine that you are lying there, you can't do anything. There is a kind of crawling insect on you. Anyway. I just thought that's one about birth. I quite like that one. Another one. Oh, the butterfly, by the way, that is to do with... it's a seasonal image for that indicates birth, often in Japanese poetry. Another one. Flecked with sand from the whirlwind, little butterfly. Flecked with sand from the whirlwind, little butterfly. Also by Issa. So the second type of suffering is old age. Everybody, hopefully, if you get to it, that would be good. So another haiku. Flies swarming, what do they want of these wrinkled hands? Flies swarming, what do they want of these wrinkled hands. Also Isa. So I have one on sickness. That's the third type of suffering. And that's a poem by Ryuka. Day to day, for countless days, thus I have managed, till at length in recent years a sickness holds me and tortures me with the fear that I might perish. Friendless like cicada shells, but few days ahead, and that I might be laid down a rotten thing beneath a rock. It's a bit sad, that one. But I picked it out because it's got the cicada shells in it. And the cicada shells in Japanese poetry are a symbol of impermanence.
So would you read that one again?
Yeah. Day to day, for countless days, thus I have managed, till at length in recent years a sickness holds me and tortures me with the fear that I might perish. Friendless like cicada shells, but few days ahead, and that I might be laid down a rotten thing beneath a rock. Anyway, a poem about sickness, which features an insect. One about death, which is the death haiku, is quite a famous, famous. It's a well-known type of haiku. And apparently these poets would, with their last breath, sometimes, create a haiku. That's what they did. Clear water is cool. Fireflies vanish. There's nothing more. Clear water is cool. Fireflies vanish. There's nothing more. So the fifth type of suffering is contact with what one dislikes. And meetings with insects are often in that category. Fleas, lice, a horse peeing near my pillow. That's the haiku. Fleas, lice, a horse peeing near my pillow. Basho. That's being in contact with things you dislike, yeah? Also, the sixth type of suffering is separation from what one likes. Yeah, so the separation from what one likes. So I've got two poems there. So, in the sky, flocks of departing geese. In the weeds, murmuring insects. Tears like dew well up in my eyes. In the sky, flocks of departing geese. In the weeds, murmuring insects. Tears like dew well up in my eyes. This is by Rengetsu, one of the few women haiku poets, famous haiku poets. And another one by Isagen, don't weep insects, lovers, stars themselves must part. That's quite a famous one. Don't weep insects, lovers, stars themselves must part. So that was the separation from what one likes. So we're getting to the last one, the last type of suffering according to the Buddhist tradition, which is not getting what one wants, not getting what one wants, the suffering created by that. So I just got two haikus here. A caterpillar, this deep in fall, still not a butterfly. A caterpillar, this deep in fall, still not a butterfly. This one by Basho. And the next one is also by Basho. The dragonfly cannot quite land on that blade of grass. The dragonfly cannot quite land on that blade of grass. So that's not getting what one wants, with a bit of imagination. Well, thank you so much for bearing with me. I'm nowhere near the end, I'm afraid, but thank you. It's in process, so thanks for bearing with me.
It was really lovely to have you for this class a long time. Thank you very much.